Okay, so I thought we're going to do some meditation, and we're going to work through the longer version, which Steph's kindly found us, of the four immeasurable thoughts. But before we do that, and then we'll go into the presentation, and I think it will be more interactive as we go along, but I'll explain as we go along a bit more two-way, a bit free flow, as there's so few of us. But I thought I'd start off with a sort of a recap of the equanimity in a sense, but a bringing it down to the ground with a couple of quotes that I've found and have found very moving. I found them a while back and have really impressed me regarding equanimity in real life. One of them is from Dr. Natalie Turtle, I'm not sure which, who works for MSF, or Doctors Without Borders, or she did then in 2018. And she was working in Mosul in Iraq. And what she said, this was in one of their fundraising packs, what drives MSF partly is the idea of equanimity. The idea that people have the same right to care and compassion, no matter what they have done or what has been done to them. This isn't difficult for me, who is a doctor from abroad. They're simply a patient. But for our staff in Mosul, who all live there, who all have similar stories of loss and grief, it is much more complicated. Imagine an armed group has taken not only your worldly possessions, your home and your chances and education, but also your friends, your family, your mental and physical health, your security, your city, and your identity. Imagine it. To say that you will stand up and treat everyone the same, equitably, is extremely complex. But they do this every day. It wasn't easy. It wasn't always absolute. But they did it, and they still do. Working with the staff in Mosul was humbling. So that's one of what is possibly even way before we're enlightened, then, if we work at it, if our mind is in the right place. And another one comes from a guy called Emad Hassan, who was released from Guantanamo Bay in 2015 after 8 years on hunger strike, protesting his innocence. And presumably, as he was released, he was innocent. He said, "While I was being fed, the block commander fell down unconscious." When he was being fed, it was force feeding. The block commander fell down unconscious. His eyes rolled back up into his head, and a choking sound came out of his chest, and his legs kicked at something invisible. I watched for a second, then two, then three. I found myself crying, calling the medical team to come. I was worried about him. I forgot who we both were. The block guards jumped to his aid, trying to help him breathe. He was taken to the hospital. Believe it or not, I was really worried about him. I tried to analyze my feelings later, but found it odd that I would do so. This is the reaction of any human, surely. But here in Guantanamo, things are different. I'm supposed to enjoy this terrible scene. I'm supposed to be happy to see this man suffer. After all, he is, as the colonel put it, an enemy. If he is truly an enemy, then I shouldn't have called the medical team over. I shouldn't have asked about his condition for the rest of the day. Yet I thanked God for my reaction. It means that I'm still human. So let's breathe, do some breathing meditation. So just settle yourself in a position, a comfortable posture that's supportive, or just connect with our motivation, do some breathing, connect with our motivation, and formalize it through the Four Immeasurables prayers, the long version. And we can do. You can join in if you wish, if it has meaning for you. If not, just continue thinking about your motivation. Okay, so first of all, connect with your seat, the ground beneath your seat, and your body. So bring the focus of your attention to the breath going in and out in a natural, calm, ordinary way. Okay, connect with our own motivation for being here. To help us to cultivate these qualities of heart and mind. Equanimity, loving kindness, compassion, and joy. And then I'll recite the verses of the Four Immeasurable Thoughts. If they have any meaning for you, by all means, join in. You don't have to, if you keep yourself muted, that would be helpful, because otherwise it sounds a bit strange. But. And we'll stop at the end of each one and connect. But if, for say, if you don't want to, then just stay with your own motivation and your breath. How wonderful it would be if all sentient beings were to abide in equanimity, free from the closeness of attachment and the distance of hatred. May they abide in equanimity. I myself will cause them to abide in equanimity. Please, Guru Deity, bless me to be able to do this. In loving kindness, how wonderful it would be if all sentient beings were to have happiness and the causes of happiness. May they have happiness and its causes. I myself will cause them to have happiness and its causes. Please, Guru Deity, bless me to be able to do this. Immeasurable compassion. How wonderful it would be if all sentient beings were free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May they be free from suffering and its causes. I myself will cause them to be free from suffering and its causes. Please, Guru Deity, bless me to be able to do this. And immeasurable joyfulness. How wonderful it would be if all sentient beings were never separated from the happiness of higher rebirth and liberation. May they never be separated from these. I myself will cause them never to be separated from these. Please, Guru Deity, bless me to be able to do this. Thanks, Steph. Okay, and when you're ready, we'll begin looking at loving kindness, also known as metta, I'd say, from Pali. The Metta Sutta is the Buddha's sutta, goes back to the time of the Buddha, that actually is the sort of the keystone for how these practices were developed in terms of beginning with the definition of metta, of loving kindness, of the quality of heart and mind, and then beginning from the center where we are ourselves, gradually going out to people who are close to us, to people who are not so close to us, who are relative strangers, to people who are we find difficult, and then eventually to all sentient beings. And focusing on, as I say, real people at each stage, not just a generic friend, but a real friend, or a generic stranger, but somebody that we have met and we can visualize. That makes it real. So metta, loving kindness, is also called, or friendliness, or there are various translations, because say love in itself is in the English language is too, we're too sloppy in our usage. You know, I love you so long as you always love me. I love my kids. I love hamburgers. You know, it's not precise enough to be helpful. So within within the Buddhist tradition, there is a specific meaning to this, what we're talking about. And it's the wish for all beings everywhere to experience only happiness and its causes, as it said in the prayer, regardless of our relationship to them. No one is excluded. That's where we're aiming for. And there are no, it's a befriending. That's another word for it. It's helpful. But there are no strings attached. It's not, I will love you if, blah-de-blah, but it's, may you be happy, or may you be happy if you fulfill these requirements, but may you be happy as a human being who just like me wants to be happy. It's not an emotion as such. It's not necessary for us in doing these meditations to feel any great, you know, sort of emotion. Emotions may arise, but it's not necessary. In this sense, it's a committed intention or aspiration. It's reminding ourselves of where we are headed. We are headed in a direction that holds everybody in this universal friendliness. And we develop it through practice until it becomes spontaneous, until it becomes whoever we see, whoever happens to cross our path, we can bring to them, we can turn to them with an open-hearted friendliness, wishing them well. And our relationship is based on that. Not that we have to love them in the sense of, you know, have to accept everything they do, but we come to them with respect, and in fact, slightly more now than respect, but based on that respect is a feeling of warmth that we're trying to develop. Until it becomes our home, that's where we reside. As I say, we can choose the divine abodes where our mind rests when we're not engaged in any particular way of thinking or being or doing, like kindness, compassion, and so on, and joy. Or we can choose hellish abodes, like greed, resentment, ill will, and so forth. But most of the time, actually, it's any old thing going through our minds, isn't it, really? But we can intentionally choose. It doesn't have to be, sort of the latest scene from EastEnders or whatever song we happen to have heard on the radio this morning before we came out or whatever. You know, we can be in control of our minds with practice. So it begs a couple of questions, that wishing for happiness and its causes. Firstly, how do we understand happiness? And secondly, what are the causes? How do we understand the causes of happiness? So again, various scholars have kind of, you know, sort of looked in depth at this question. Alan Wallace, if you've ever read any of his books or come across any of his, he's devoted quite a lot of time to devote to defining what we mean by happiness and the various kinds. But basically, there is what we generally in society call happiness, which is that which is stimulus driven. In other words, we're depending on outer stimuli, things from outside, which will make us happy, we say. I'll be happy when I have a lovely meal. I'll be happy if I have a nice, or I am happy if I have a nice place to live or good experiences. And that's fine. Again, there's nothing wrong with that. I'm not belittling that because, external stimuli include things like having a decent home, having good health, having enough to eat and drink, feeling safe. You know, they're not, it's not all trivial. These things can be important. And important causes, Buddhism would say conditions for our happiness. Happiness itself, they say, there's more to it than that. We can go deeper, and there can be an inner happiness, which actually is independent of external stimuli. But, you know, there are people, I'm sure we've read about whether, you know, sort of the great teachers or even in everyday life, but there are people who live in, you know, terrible conditions, but still manage to have at least moments of happiness if they're not you know, sort of totally there. Happiness itself is a genuine, there is a genuine a source of, which is an inner resource that actually we all have, but we don't necessarily all recognize. They kind of, it's a sense of flourishing that rises up from within, whatever the circumstances. And maybe, you know, probably, again, we've maybe had glimpses of that. Maybe we know it well, but, you know, maybe we've had glimpses of that in terms of, you know, if we've been doing a meditation practice, sometimes, you know, we've just felt this great sense of contentment, of things being exactly as they need to be. There's no need for anything else. In fact, the Buddha defined three kind of levels of this inner happiness. There's that which is based on a clear conscience and contentment. And actually here we're moving into the causes of happiness. So a clear conscience and contentment. There's a happiness, a level of happiness, which is dependent on our level of concentration. So when we're, say, we're in a deep meditation, if we manage to get there, then that in itself allows this wellspring of happiness to bubble up. And again, we've maybe had experience of that. Or maybe just in life when we're kind of doing something like, you know, a sport or something like that, or cooking or whatever. But, you know, they say in the flow, it's in the flow. It's that kind of inner feeling, not excitement or anything, but just that feeling of complete well-being and flourishing. And then there's the third level that we described is the complete and, you know, untainted level of happiness, which is when we really are in tune with how reality exists. It's the deep understanding of wisdom, the deep happiness that comes with wisdom, when we become liberated from all suffering, they say. So there's these various levels of happiness, which, you know, we can work our way through, or we can learn to access, learn to abide in. And particularly if we know the causes, one of the basics of the Buddhist approach is that while we all want, in fact, there's another quote from Shantideva, that while we all want happiness and want to avoid suffering, mostly because of this basic misunderstanding of how things exist, we generally, as you say, we rush towards suffering in our sort of daily activities, and we destroy happiness as if it's an enemy. That's kind of sort of paraphrasing, but that's what he says. Because basically, if we only believe that happiness resides outside of ourselves, this external happiness is all that there is, you know, well, A, we're cheating ourselves because there is so much more. And we know also that external stimuli, external happiness, you know, it's great while it lasts, but there's no guarantee that it will always last. There's no guarantee that it will always cause us happiness. You know, one piece of chocolate cake, talking over lunch, you know, one piece of chocolate cake is fine, two is okay, three is pretty nauseating, really. So, you know, the happiness clearly doesn't reside, or the cause of happiness doesn't reside in the chocolate cake. It resides in our mind. And often that mind is the contentment with having one piece of chocolate cake or whatever we have. So again, you know, when we're wishing for people to have happiness and its causes as well, we're not wishing for them to have, we're thinking about this internal happiness, the long-term causes. You know, it may be that somebody could be happy with, you know, a crack cocaine or something, but, you know, that's not a long-term happiness, of course, a long-term cause of happiness, or a cause of long-term, real, genuine happiness. So what we're wishing for people is the causes, you know, wholesome, healthy, you know, sort of intermediate, everyday happiness, but mainly, you know, sort of for them to gain an understanding of the real causes of happiness and for them to be able to follow. With me so far, yeah? Okay. So when all of these immeasurables are described, there comes a definition of what it is, and also a definition of what it's not. And what it's not clearly is the direct opposite, which is ill will or this aversion, you know, wanting to push something away. And going through all the you know, the various levels of resentment, ill will, to hatred, to whatever. So that's the opposite of loving kindness, which is very clear, the far enemy. And they talk about the near enemy, which is really something which is a facsimile, can be mistaken for happiness, for, yeah, for friendliness, for loving kindness rather. And that's often described, the word is often used as attachment, which again, it's one of those words that comes with difficulties because the John Bowlby's sort of psychological sort of description of children, of babies having been properly attached to their parents, is not what we're talking about here. When we talk about attachment, we're talking about basically something that is comes from a space of neediness, of my need. I want you to be happy, provided you make me happy, provided you do this. And actually, my real concern is my happiness. So I need you to be with me. It's that exaggeration of love. It's kind of taking it. Well, it's not taking it too far. It's kind of a, it's just a misplaced. It's based on my need and not just on what will make you happy. It's what will make you happy, provided that makes me happy too. It's kind of self-serving, really. And also, it kind of depends on, you know, you've got to stay the same, don't change. Do always what I want you to do. Be always how I want you to be. So it's, you know, for the person who's on, we maybe know this ourselves from experience, on the receiving end of that, that can feel very, you know, manipulative and constricting in a way. So that's what it's not. And what's they talk about the proximate cause, the immediate trigger, if we want to help, if we want to generate genuine loving kindness, then the proximate cause, a bit like I said in the story this morning of when I was teaching, it's looking for the good, seeing the lovable, the good in people. With friends, we can, family, we can do this easily, people we care about, that's all we see. Mostly, not always, but you know, that's predominantly what we see. We see their good qualities. With other people, people that we don't know, we've got to work a bit harder, haven't we, to kind of, you know, sort of look for the good qualities, how they might be seen as lovable to other people. And of course, with people that we don't like, that we would rather not be around, then we've got to work really hard. And that means challenging, as we said this morning, our view of how they are, of how we see them, recognising the limits of our perception. The more we become familiar with this, the more we can greet people with this warmth and open-hearted acceptance. The quote from Christina Feldman, she wrote a book that's in the resources list that is a really great introduction from the Pali tradition to these four immeasurables, which is a really beautiful, beautifully written book. She says, we don't have to love the difficult, but we can care about it or them, if it's people, and befriend it or them. And what does she mean by befriend? I think this is quite nice. We begin by accepting what it is. So whatever the person, there is the person in front of us. We accept that this is a person in front of us. We see clearly, as His Holiness says, you know, their behaviour, but we can separate the person and their behaviour. We turn towards it, she says, with a curiosity and openness. So we're prepared to be surprised, to not just go with our prejudices, but to try and see clearly what really is there, and to be open, to try and understand. And then from that basis, to act in a as friendly a way as possible. But, you know, it might be that in a friendly way we have to stop somebody in their behaviour, or we have to call out somebody for their behaviour. But it comes from a place of care, of understanding, of not a judgment, discrimination in terms of we discriminate what is healthy and what is not. But it's from a place of, you know, kindness, as you would correct a child in a loving way who's misbehaving. So sometimes, sometimes we can go a bit too far. And it becomes a self-centered attachment if we're not doing it quite right. It goes into that near enemy. Or also sometimes it can become a bit spacey or ungrounded. If we don't kind of keep it real, I think. You know, it can be, oh, I love humanity. It's just people I can't stand, you know. So that's why we use the in our meditations, we focus on real people, not people, kind of thing. If we do go too far in the wrong direction, then it's recommended that we bring in one of the other measurables, which is compassion. So we leave that to one side if we find it, you know, it's not, we're getting a bit out of balance, and we bring in a bit of compassion. We focus on, if we're getting too spacey, we focus on somebody who we know is suffering, maybe ourselves who is suffering, and then we work around that. That can be a way of doing it. There are barriers, of course. You know, one of the barriers is our feelings. What we said, you know, we naturally feel like, dislike, and so forth, and we naturally believe them. So those are barriers to developing. So we work on that with equanimity. Another barrier, I think, that Christina Feldman pointed out in her book is what she calls the myth of authenticity, that somehow or other, we have to, you know, our first, we believe in it. I think it is quite common in our culture. Whatever is our first reaction to somebody or something, that's our authentic, that's the real me. That's being, and we're acting from that is being true to myself somehow. You know, it comes up in Shakespeare, isn't it? In one of his play Hamlet, I think, you know, be to thine own self, be true. And she says, and it convinced me that actually, if that's what we do, if we follow that line, okay, I don't like this person, so I'm justified, I'm being honest if I express my dislike of that person, and don't try to do anything with it. Just, you know, let it go. She says what we're doing is we're being true to emotional habits that don't serve us well and don't serve community, the world well. But if something arises spontaneously, as I think I said earlier, all it means is, spontaneous means it is habitual. It is something we do regularly. So if resentment is something that we dwell in regularly, then that will arise spontaneously, or it may well if we meet the correct conditions. So to be true to that, is, you know, we're not going anywhere. All we're doing is strengthening negative habits, to be honest. To recognize it, not to suppress it or deny it, to recognize it, not to judge it, just say, oh, no, there's aversion. Don't want to go there. That's not helpful, or resentment. Been there, done that. Know it's painful to me and doesn't help any situation. So can I try to work with this? And it's so we don't suppress or deny them, but she suggests that we gently examine and we question. So we think, okay, because if we, you know, if we equate emotional reactivity with freedom, you know, or authenticity, then we can justify all sorts of racist or abusive language, for example, or behaviour, just because it's spontaneous, it's real. That's not a good way to go. So the question, you know, the question I ask, you know, if these emotions, these feelings come up, is, you know, does this lead to genuine happiness for myself or others? Or does it lead, if I follow it, does it lead to relatedness? Or does it lead to alienation? Do I become closer to people? Can I work with them more effectively? Or does it create barriers between us? So that, you know, that's the question we can ask ourselves. Okay, so, and loving kindness in the Buddhist thing counteracts hatred or ill will, which if you're familiar with the three poisons that we talk about, which is the basis of suffering, actually, the three poisons of greed or attachment, aversion or ill will, hatred, all born of ignorance, this misunderstanding. Greed, hatred, and ignorance is often a shorthand for those. So loving kindness counteracts hatred or ill will, clearly, because it's the opposite. If loving kindness exists in our mind, hatred can't be there at the same time, or ill will or resentment. So the stronger, the more familiar we become with one, the less space there is for the other to develop, and vice versa. So we choose, where do we want to go? Okay, so I've talked quite a lot. So let's just open it up a bit now, and I'd be interested to hear your views on this. So what are the problems in our life? What are the problems that we found or can imagine if we allow aversion and ill will to remain in our minds, if we don't try to counteract them, if we just let them be, let them grow, let them fester or whatever? What are the dangers? Why do we bother to try and change them? What are the dangers? Over to you, any suggestions?
Will cause people to suffer.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. A lot of unhappiness.
Yeah. Yeah. Suffering and unhappiness will be around, will cause other people to suffer for sure, because we're acting from that place, sorry. And that brings up unhappiness, doesn't it? Anything else?
Can you tell us what the three poisons are again, please?
Yeah, sure. They're often just kind of off the cuff as in their extreme forms, greed, hatred, and ignorance. So in their, you know, their subtler forms, it's aversion, attachment to getting things that we want, having things our own way. Aversion, when we don't get things our own way and people get in our way of that. And those are born of ignorance, of misunderstanding the way that things exist. And also misunderstanding, various levels of misunderstanding, actually, in terms of how our behaviour affects others, the results of different behaviours, and so on. So allowing ill will to grow and to remain in our mind streams causes suffering for others and causes unhappiness. Anything else?
It's very isolating, isn't it?
Yes. Mm. Do you want to say a little bit more about that?
Just that, yeah, something about if you're carrying a lot of that around you, then it doesn't only isolate you from that person, but also the people around you, because they will be picking up on that too. So it's, you know, you become a little bit of an island in your own hatred and aversion of maybe just one particular person. And it can make you, I believe it can make you ill. I believe it can physically manifest as well.
Mm. That's excellent.
No, I think that's true. Mm-hmm. It becomes a habit as well by practicing it, by allowing it to be there. Then actually, I believe it kind of, you know, when we go into a situation with other people, we're also feeling isolated. We're ready to protect ourselves because we see aversion. Aversion looms big. We see danger out there. Ill will is rooted in fear of harm and loss. So that becomes exaggerated, you know, the possibility of harm and loss becomes exaggerated. So whenever we enter, you know, a space, a public space, then the chances are we are kind of checking out, am I safe? Mm. Sometimes, you know, in people's experiences, there are, you know, there are good reasons to do that. But, you know, if early life experiences have been difficult, you know, I'm not judging that, but the more that we can open up to, feel safe enough to open up to friendliness and the possibility of friendliness of others, then, you know, the easier it is to connect. And, you know, then we often get back what we reflect out. And as you were saying, people can pick up, can't they, on our vibes as we're going around. If we're in a bad mood, not only are we, I don't know about you, but if I'm kind of lost in, you know, chuntering on about, you know, somebody's upset me and I'm, you know, dare they do that? What do they? Then actually, it's a very closed and narrow and claustrophobic space, isn't it? You're not even necessarily aware of other people around you until you've bumped into them or trod on their feet or something. You know? So it really is alienating, isn't it, in that way? And, you know, you were saying, Leilani, you know, that we hurt other people. But we harm ourselves, you know, physically, mentally as well, and you know, socially. The image that I've always loved, talking about, you know, acting out of ill will, is it's like picking up a hot coal and chucking it at somebody. You may hurt them, you may burn them, but you sure as hell will burn your own hand. Mm. And that's, you know, that's just in the immediate, without thinking of longer term sort of karmic consequences that may come from indulging in ill will. Again, Christina Feldman, she kind of comes up with a long list, actually, of you know, what happens, what it feels like to be in the midst of ill will, you know, coming from that perspective of being aware, you know, of the mindfulness of our behaviour. I recognise this, it often leads to kind of agitated behaviour, this agitated state of mind of going around trying to fix things or trying to get people to agree with us about them, you know, that kind of thing. And she said, and it's true as well from my experience, that it leeches joy and happiness from our life. You know, there's no space for being happy when we're kind of, you know, in this tight space. It leads to obsessive thinking. You get over and over and over again. They said this, I should have said that, but they did this, and then I should have done that. You know, it just goes on and on, doesn't it? Or it can do if we go with it. And as you said, it leads to distance and separation. And it can be habit forming. You know, that's, I think, the worst thing of it. You know, in terms of our understanding of how karma works, you know, the more every time we give in to ill will and to aversion, we are making that habit stronger. You know, there's an acceptance now of how neural pathways in our brains can be, you know, sort of deepened by, or, you know, made stronger by using us going down that same pathway over and over again. The same in our minds, in our, you know, our mental experience. You know, the more we do something, the stronger it becomes. You know, we know that. The more we overeat, the easier it is to overeat.
On the positive side, it's actually true that the more we concentrate on compassion, the more we actually connecting the neurons on that part of the brain as well, which
absolutely.
Is rather encouraging.
Yes. Absolutely, yeah, thank you. That was where I was coming next. So
sorry.
Well, no, that's fine. That's good. Yeah. That's fine. Enough of the negative stuff. This is loving kindness. Let's be positive. You're right. So
okay.
So how loving kindness helps, you know, we clearly see the harm of ill will that we do to ourselves and others. We know it, we feel it when we're in it, we know it. And if we believe we have a choice, and not everybody does believe we have a choice, but if we believe we have a choice, then we can make this committed intention to overcome it, to start deepening those other neural pathways and mental karmic pathways. And actually, while kindness or loving kindness, friendliness is the direct opposite to ill will, the dynamic is, or ill will is the primary obstacle to kindness. The most direct way to overcome ill will is by loving kindness. Hatred doesn't cease by hatred alone, by kindness alone. So, you know, if we can make that strong, you know, the way to reduce ill will is to, as you've said, to develop the opposite, to develop those pathways of loving kindness. So that's where we're most familiar, where we're most at home. So, yeah, it's a path of cultivation. It's something we learn to do. It's something we build up gradually. And in terms of loving kindness and avoiding not just ill will, but avoiding attachment we can see sometimes people think that, you know, if I'm loving, it'll make me vulnerable. But actually, a loving heart, if we don't realize that the love resides in our heart and doesn't reside in the other person to make us, it's not the other person's job to make us happy. The love is in our heart and we there can develop it. That actually gives us a great deal of strength. You know, we're not reliant on the other person for our love to develop. Our love can develop. It's our responsibility, basically, for our love to develop, not somebody else. Somebody else can help or can be a condition, but developing our love is our responsibility and it becomes our strength. So the benefits of, flipping it over the other side, the benefits of developing love for ourselves and for the world, what are they? What might they be? Who would you, again? Why bother, again? Why bother, you know, not only why bother trying to get rid of the negative stuff, why bother trying to cultivate the positive stuff? Any thoughts? What are the benefits to ourselves and to the world? Seems like a dumb question, doesn't it? So obvious.
Yeah, it's difficult to sum it up. I mean, for ourselves, I think it gives that what we're all about, that sense of love and balance in our lives and all of that. It puts us in a totally different place. I mean, meditation does that, actually. It's quite extraordinary. But hopefully that we're developing something that's kind of feeding into the energy of the earth or something to make it into a better place. Because I think if there was enough of us doing that, I really do think we would change the world, actually, and the way people think around us.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah.
What do you think, Claire?
It's interesting, isn't it? Because it is, it goes back to benefiting others in the kind of longer term. But I think I won't be able to quote the Dalai Lama, but you know, he says it's not completely selfless developing compassion and loving kindness, because we are benefiting ourselves too, you know. And it seems crazy not to do it, doesn't it? If we really believe what you know our teachers tell us about our innate goodness, then we're going back home to who we actually are, rather than how we've maybe been brought up because of the culture or just the way that our heads work. Then it simplifies life, doesn't it, and makes it much more enjoyable for yourself and for those around you too. So, I mean, there's masses of physical and mental health benefits from feeling those feelings, those positive qualities or beneficial qualities. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's lovely, especially remembering that actually our original nature is goodness. And in our culture, we forget that, don't we?
Mm.
Yeah, well, it's not necessary that we forget it, but actually there is a counter myth, isn't there, or a counter argument that people say, well, actually, you know, civilization is only skin deep, scratch the surface, and, you know, out comes, you know, all the nasty stuff, which is the real us, which is a very destructive, cynical view of things. But it is predominant, I think, in our culture. It's certainly very, I don't know if it's maybe not the biggest, but it's certainly very extensive. But to think, you know, that genuinely, you know, our nature is love, compassion, connectedness, and all the rest of it, which is what the Buddhist view is very important. There's a book out by a Dutch guy called Rutger Bregman, I don't know if you've seen around, called Humankind. And he specifically goes into that point that, you know, that there is this narrative around that human beings, it's based on, you know, the book Lord of the Flies, the William Golding, and based on that nature, that book, actually he kind of says it comes out of that book, where, you know, that people start off civilized, but, you know, very soon it all breaks down and our true animal nature.
That's awful.
Yeah, which is awful, but it, you know, it has gained great traction, and he, you know, he kind of describes how some of that goes. And he also, on each count, describes actually that that isn't the case. And in fact, there was a real life case where some young boys did get marooned on a desert island, and they were there for about a year or something like that before they eventually were found and you know, brought back home. And in fact, the story was quite the opposite. They cared for each other, they looked after each other, they cooperated. Mm-hmm. But that's not the story that gets told. The story that gets told is the other one. And that was born, you know, from Gunter Rutger Bregman, you know, a writer, William Golding, who was just so depressed after what happened in the Second World War. It's written shortly after that, that was his view then of humanity. And it's kind of stayed. And, you know, Rutger Bregman wrote this book to say, hey, you know, this view has consequences. You know, if we continue with this view, it's a bit like I was saying earlier, that we you know, it's important to cultivate within ourselves, and maybe to then be able to share this view that, you know, actually human beings are very positive. There is a lot of positivity around, and this is our true nature. So I think, yeah. It does seem a no-brainer, doesn't it?
Yeah. Which is what the Tibetans think, actually. They don't get us at all, because they grow up with this idea that they are internally Buddhas. They have this Buddha nature, mm. and they're intrinsically good.
Mm.
And that's their view.
Yeah.
Which is beautiful.
Yeah. And they all seem to be pretty happy, don't they, as well?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Sally, did you want to add anything to us at all?
Claire?
No, Sally. Yeah.
Hi.
Sally, thank you, pardon.
Yeah, I absolutely believe that's who we are. I absolutely believe in our true nature, our Buddha nature, absolutely. And if we think that the path that we're on specifically is about getting to enlightenment for the benefit of everyone else, it's not about us. You know, it's becoming a bodhisattva. It's coming back and back and back until you are enlightened and you can help everyone get to that same place. So how else are we going to do that unless we're coming from a place of love and compassion and our true nature for every living being, not just humans either, you know, everyone, everybody in all the realms, everywhere. We can only become enlightened by doing that, by living from our true nature at all times, trying to anyway, you know. We're not enlightened, none of us right now, but, you know, we're striving. That's where we're trying to get to, you know.
Yeah. And I guess the fact, thanks, Sally, I guess the fact even that we, you know, that humans have these aspirations and express it in so many different religions and forms and philosophies and things like that, you know, speaks volumes to this, you know, this true nature that must be there somehow, even if it does get hidden and distorted and, you know, comes out in all sorts of weird and wonderful ways.
Yeah, all of the religions point to the same thing. Everything. It's all about love, kindness, compassion, empathy, joy, you know, connecting with each other. Every single religion says the same thing. It's just all the details that change, you know, within each one. But it all pretty much points to the same thing. Be a good human, because that's what we are underneath all of the egoic stuff. You know, we're good. We're all good. We're intrinsically good. Yeah. All of us.
Yeah. I feel a t-shirt coming on. We're all good. Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. So Yeah, how are we doing? Good. Let's take a break here, and then we'll come back, and after a very brief introduction, we'll do a meditation on loving kindness. Is that okay with everybody? Yeah, so if we come back, say, at 10 past three, is that okay? Perfect. Long enough, just for a wee break?
Yeah, great. Yeah, thanks, Lynn. Thanks. Thank you.